Welcome to Historical Jesus. I'm Mark Vinette. What kind of monarch and man was Herod the Great? During his long reign, King Herod left his mark. But how shall he be remembered in memory and by history? At the time when Jesus was born, the current oppressor of the Holy Land was Imperial Rome, which had lumped Judea, Galilee, and a dozen other neighboring peoples in with Syria to the north, under a prefect appointed by the emperor. Sometimes the chosen method of government for Judea was a Roman proconsul or governor, who usually reported to the prefect at Antioch, in modern-day Turkey. At other times, Rome would install a client king, preferably a Jew, to provide a veneer of Jewish independence. Such a king had been Herod the Great, who took power 59 years after the Roman conquest, and who was regarded by many as a sort of fake Jew. He was, in fact, from a neighboring people to the south, whom the Jews, in a moment of ascendancy, a century earlier, had coerced into Judaism. Herod, succeeding his father, a sycophant of Rome, had parlayed this modest opportunity skillfully, and had made himself Rome's indispensable and reliable cat's paw over much of the Middle East. He ruled with fierce consistency, bringing peace to the area for the whole 41 years of his reign by ruthlessly exterminating the slightest manifestations of anti-Roman nationalism. At the same time, he tried to ingratiate himself with the Jews by creating architectural wonders whose scale and grandeur would astonish archaeologists 20 centuries later. He built for himself numerous palaces, four of them within 30 miles of Jerusalem. Nothing could equal these for lavish summer luxury. But by far the greatest and most magnificent of his palaces, named to honor his patron, the Emperor Augustus, and his great general, Marcus Agrippa, stood on the western edge of Jerusalem's upper city. Its two vast reception halls enabled Herod to entertain hundreds of guests, while its opulent bedrooms and colonnaded courtyards, gardens, and fountains brought renown even in faraway Rome. Peering from above it all were its three stout towers. In Jerusalem, he also rebuilt and strengthened the city's walls and erected a Roman amphitheater, something many Jews did not appreciate, since it smacked of Hellenism, the hated culture of the Greeks which, since its insinuation into Palestine with Alexander the Great 300 years before, the Jews had persistently, though hopelessly, resisted. At Caesarea, 50 miles northwest of Jerusalem, Herod had pushed breakwaters out from the Mediterranean beaches to create and enclose a superb harbor, its entrance adorned with six spectacular monuments. Beside the harbor, he built a model Roman city, with its amphitheater and hippodrome, its underground sewer system, and its crafted streets meeting at precise right angles. Finally, he erected, as possible refuges for himself in case of insurrection, a system of desert fortresses, chief among them, one east of the Dead Sea, one west of it, and most impregnable of all, Masada, overlooking the Dead Sea from a mountaintop so precipitous and treacherous that few conquerors would be determined enough to scale it in sufficient strength to take the fortress itself. But most prized by the Jews was his reconstruction of the temple at Jerusalem, including a building of such awesome scale that it seemed to be as physically permanent as the spiritual strength it represented. There was at least one connective between Jesus and Herod. The former was born in or about the year that the latter died. In the tradition of Jesus' followers, there was another link. Herod once made aware that the celestial occurrences which ostensibly attended the child's birth had set off rumors that Jesus was the expected Messiah, had reacted characteristically and butchered every infant in the vicinity. Harsh, perhaps, but then, which was worse? The liquidation of a few score infants, or yet another religious movement which would rapidly become yet another Jewish independence crusade, occasioning yet another crackdown by Rome, resulting in yet another slaughter of thousands. Where possible, you nipped such weeds in the bud. That was Rome's way, and under Herod, the policy had one indisputable thing going for it. For the most part, it worked. It preserved peace. Let's learn more about this titan of history from Seth Schwartz, professor of classical Jewish civilization at New York City's Columbia University.
The memory of Herod. The kingdom of Judea, the period of the kingship of Herod. It's not only in Christian tradition that he's remembered. The later Jewish tradition also had a fairly similar picture of him. They also regarded him as evil and cruel. There is no story in rabbinic literature about Herod as a second pharaoh. But there is the notorious tale, which is straight from the spirit of Josephus. Josephus says that after he had his wife Mariamne, the Hasmonean princess, executed, he was overcome by longing for her. He was in mental and spiritual disarray because of his great love for her and what had happened. There's a story in rabbinic literature that Herod had her corpse preserved in honey, and he used to visit her and sleep with her and engage in necrophilia while she was preserved in honey. So it's not exactly the same as the mass murder of infants, but it doesn't paint him in a very positive light either. So Herod had very bad press. He really got very bad press, and it was deserved. The fact that he was a great institution builder was something that people who lived under his thumb might not necessarily have always thought about too much. Interestingly, at exactly the same time when the rabbis living and working after the destruction of the Herodian temple in the year 70, after the Jewish rebellion, the first rabbinic text is 150 years later, and they're looking back on the period of the second temple. The temple that they think of is not the temple which had stood for maybe 300 or 400 years before Herod came along with its modest proportions. They idealized the Herodian temple. Idealized in a way which they knew that it was the Herodian temple. It's not that they expressed gratitude to Herod for having constructed it. It was part of this, how wonderful things were for us in the olden days. And part of that wonderfulness was this massive piece of Herodian construction. This idea had to wait for the 20th century. It was actually the view of several influential scholars, one in particular, Abraham Shalit, who played up this angle that he may not have been imperfect, but he was great and he was a tremendous leader and powerful. So that's not something that you can find in any ancient source, except possibly in the earlier work of Josephus. That is, Josephus himself writing in the 70s or early 80s in the aftermath of the destruction of Jerusalem, when he's writing about Herod in his earlier work from that period, there's kind of the idea that this is, despite all the personal problems, which were not irrelevant because ancients were very concerned about character and intellectuals worried about the character of their leaders. And Herod clearly had a bad character. Nevertheless, it was clear that he was also in some respects an effective leader and that there were ways in which the things that he did while king, especially in relationship to Rome, could be deployed as a model for effective relations between some Jewish polity and the Roman state. That's the line that Josephus seems to be, largely by implication, pushing in his earlier work. So, yes, Josephus actually has the germ of that idea in his History of the Jewish War, and he abandons it in his later work. Herod did things that no previous Jewish ruler would have ever had the temerity to do. In the year 167 BC, the Hasmonean revolt broke out against the Seleucids, in part, had given permission for the construction of a gymnasium at Jerusalem. Herod took the initiative and built both a theater and an amphitheater at Jerusalem, which is roughly the same thing in terms of its cultural baggage. And he kind of got away with it. Partly times had changed. The fact is that after Herod's time, we don't hear another word about these buildings, and there's no archaeological trace of them. So it doesn't look as if they completely survived very long. They might have been built of wood. But he's doing things in an effort to claim Jerusalem as a proper Eastern Roman city and to claim his kingdom as a proper client kingdom of the Romans, interested in playing the political game that the Romans want them to play. He's taking fairly drastic steps, and they're steps which actually seem to have displeased many of his subjects. But what Herod was trying to do, partly by instinct, was just to try to thread the needle, try to give the Romans enough to keep them happy and to give his various constituents enough to keep them happy, with all the internal zero-sum games within his kingdom, possibly a zero-sum game between Jews and Romans on the broader international stage. It may have been a losing proposition, but he was part of the Romans' tinkering in the East. That is, Herod is doing the tinkering himself. And he almost gets it, but he doesn't quite get it. And maybe if he hadn't been such an awful person as a human being, he might have been more successful. By the way, there's an interesting distinction in Jewish tradition between the reception of Herod and the reception of his grandson, who for a brief period ruled the entire Herodian kingdom. King Agrippa I, who in the year 41 inherited the entirety of his grandfather's kingdom, which was given to him by the newly crowned emperor Claudius as an act of gratitude for his friendship. There is no way to spot any political difference between Herod and Agrippa and his grandson. They seem to be doing exactly the same things to try to please the exact same constituencies. But there was something about him, something maybe slightly intangible. Josephus himself said that Herod was widely reputed to have favored the Greeks over the Jews, and Agrippa was widely understood to have favored the Jews over the Greeks. And this is confirmed in the way rabbinic literature receives King Agrippa, because they regard him as someone who is of tainted ancestry, but nevertheless, he's a member of the team. He's a good guy. The fact that he was like the boon companion of the future emperor Caligula, they didn't even know that. But Josephus did, but he still writes what he writes. I mean, that's clearly a correct description of the memory of Agrippa compared to the memory of Herod. So there was just something about him. He was a better actor than his grandfather had been. He figured it out, but it was probably too late.
I'm Mark Vinette. Thank you for sharing your time with me. Doctors endorse it, nutritionists recommend it, and customers love it. Calotrin Healthy Weight Loss. Ron in Texas lost 35 pounds. Marie in Pennsylvania lost 117 pounds with Calotrin. Diane not only lost weight, but she also found relief from arthritis. Lynn lost over 45 pounds. Calotrin contains collagen, the most abundant protein naturally occurring in the human body, which decreases as we age. Taking Calotrin promotes better sleep, more energy, less joint pain, and best of all, weight loss. Calotrin has an amazing 86% success rate with their 90-day supply. And this week, take advantage of their President's Day sale. Buy the 90-day supply and get an extra month free, plus free shipping. Ordering is so easy. Just text the word HISTORY to the code 30605, and we'll send you a link to this special offer. Again, text HISTORY, that's HISTORY, using the code 30605.